Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 2nd, 2005. Today's session, The Ethical Dilemma of Stem Cell Research, presented in the Fireside Room by Ronald Lang. Disc number LAR-2005-01. Let's listen in.
And I'd like to correct the notion that a lot of people have gotten from the media is that scientists are atheists. And I don't find that to be true. It might be that when you graduate with an undergraduate degree in physics, you tend to be a little bit atheistic or some such thing. But by the time you go through graduate school and you start studying the real world, you begin to realize that all problems are not explained by physics. And you need God and other things in your life. And I don't happen to see that science and religion are opposed to one another, and I'll tell you why. Or at least I'll tell you one reason why. When I took my first physics course in college, my first semester of freshman physics, the professor in front of me did some experiment. I don't remember what the experiment was, and it doesn't matter what it was, but he did something that I didn't understand. He did something and maybe a spark jumped between two balls. Something happened that I didn't understand. And what I don't understand, I think of as magic. A magician does tricks that we don't understand. He cuts a woman in half and he doesn't explain how he does it. So we say that's magic, and we go to him to see these things, see him do things that we don't understand. An aside is that a scientist does things that he doesn't understand either, but he figures them out. And once he figures them out, he tells everybody about it. He publishes them. So in a way, a scientist is a very poor magician because he reveals his tricks. He reveals what he's learned. Well, at any rate, I asked the professor, I raised my hand and I said, why does that happen? Why does what I see happen? And he turned to me and he said, you know, the question of why is a religious question. Science does not ask why, science asks how. How can you explain something? Not why does it happen, but how can you explain this phenomenon we see? So throughout my talk today, maybe we'll come back to this question of why versus how, because it's certainly an important question when you're talking about religion and science. Now, this morning, in the Bible course that many of us went to, we talked about Genesis 1. And in Genesis 1, there is a statement that Adam and Eve had children, and the children looked like them. Particularly their third child. The third child looked just like Adam. It says so in the Bible. Now, when we look around the world, we don't see that all people look alike. If they were all descended from Adam and Eve, how can we explain the fact that we don't look alike? We do observe that our children tend to look like us. Other people's children look like them. You can say, oh, he looks just like his father. Oh, she looks just like her mother. So there is a resemblance. So if we're considering the issue of inheritance, the inheritance of traits, if you will, that we have a story in Genesis about the inheritance of traits. The children look like their parents, Adam and Eve. We see that in our own life. But when we look around, we don't all look alike. You can easily distinguish us. It's up to the scientist to understand, to explain how that can happen. If you ask me, why is it we look alike? I have to say, because that's the way God wants it. Why we do not look alike is a religious question. How we can explain why we don't look alike, that's a question of science. So I'm going to talk a little about science today. And I'm going to talk particularly about the issue of the inheritance of traits, because that's really why we are concerned with stem cells. When we talk about stem cells, we are talking about using some magical cell. And a stem cell is magical. And I'll tell you why I think so later. We're talking about taking something that we do not understand much about, and we will use it to cure human disease. We'll use something we don't understand very well. We don't understand stem cells very well, but we're going to use it to cure human disease. Why can we do that? Because God wants us to do it. How can we do it? That's what the scientist has to figure out. So let me go back now, and I can say one thing about why we don't all look alike. I can say, well, it's been a long time since Adam and Eve. Things have happened during that time. And a little later we'll talk about the kinds of things that can happen. But there's so many generations that we have changed. Let me show you, and we'll have to push something because it's gone to sleep. But let me show you an example of someone who has, let's see if I can just, there we go. Oops, there we go. Someone that has a short enough genetic life that they do look like their parents. Now, this is the ruler of our house. This was taken at about 6 months old. She's now 10 months old, and she absolutely controls her house. She's our class A cat. We have another cat that's three times heavier and about five times larger. And this cat just dominates that bigger cat. Jumps on her, wrestles her, chases her around. She's a very active cat, and that is one of the traits of this breed. This is a Burmese cat. Her name is Mia, M-Y-A, which is in Burmese is emerald, and she is a gem of a cat. Before we got her, I looked up on the internet and found all the traits of Burmese cats, and they are all very similar. It's a purebred cat. They were first generated or something in the 1930s by a physician who brought over a cat from Burma, an Oriental cat from Burma, and he bred it to a Siamese cat. And those two cats are the Adam and Eve of the Burmese cat family. All Burmese cats are descended from those two parents. And the cat breeders are very, very careful to only breed Burmese cats with Burmese cats. So here's a type of animal that was created a relatively short time ago. And because of that, their traits are all very similar. You read on the internet that these are very smart cats. They and the Siamese are supposed to be the two smartest cat breeds that we have. She is enormously smart. They are very loyal. They like to be around people. She follows us around the house, and she's got to sit somewhere near us. She's got yellow eyes. Notice her yellow eyes. All Burmese cats have yellow eyes. That's not true of other types of cats. It's not true of Siamese cats, for example. Siamese cats, their lineage goes further back, but these only go back to the 30s. All of them have the same yellow eyes. The shading might be a little different, but they're basically the same. They all have this very short face. Very, very short face. It's so short that they sometimes have breathing problems. And she sounds strange when she first comes up to you and you know, is smelling you or whatever she does. And she sounds funny. It's a very unique sound. Then she gets over that. They're a very stocky cat. They never get terribly big. They have a body that's about the same diameter as their legs, so they have very long legs. They can jump long distances. I mean, months ago, she could jump over the couch. She could jump over the couch the long way, and she does that. She's a great show-off. He likes to show how far she can jump, how fast she can run, how far she can throw her little felt mouse up in the air. She can probably now jump from the floor to the top of the refrigerator. That's true of all Burmese cats. They all have this trait. They are great jumpers, they're fast, she is not a particularly unique Burmese cat. She's like most all Burmese cats. There's a little difference in the males and the females. The males tend to be a little smaller. The females tend to be a little smaller. The males are a little bigger. And the males are some way more docile. They will sit in a chair and look around. The females run the place. They're the boss. And they let it be known that they want to control the world. So Peggy and I are her staff. And the other cat is her servant or something. And she basically runs our house. So this is an example of the inheritance of traits from one generation to another, where the time between her and the original Adam and Eve of her breed is so small that the traits are all the same. So now we can turn this off. I also, of course, like to show the picture because we miss her a lot. Three
just the catch.
Is that called a cat fix?
I think so. So what I'd like to do, I'd like to start out on this topic by talking a little about the inheritance of traits. And I've got a list on here of the order in which I want to talk, and I think I'll put that up. That's my crib sheet. I just found out like Sunday night that I was going to talk, and that this was so I didn't have time really to I didn't have time to get a lot of slides and stuff like that, so I do have a list of the order in which I'm going to talk about. So what I'd like to do is talk about the inheritance of traits. Now, a long time ago, back in the 1830s, maybe the late 1830s, in England, pigeon raising was a very popular hobby. And there are many kinds of pigeons. There are pigeons with top knots and not top knots, with feathers on their feet and not feathers on their feet. And somebody got interested in the inheritance of pigeons. Could they take, for example, two pigeons and breed them in such a way that the children had feathers on their feet? Things like that. Could they develop a pigeon that had certain traits? Maybe that was in one of the parents and not the other, or maybe that wasn't in either parent. So this issue of could you do that? Kind of early genetic engineering, but this was with pigeons, not with people. So a scientist studied that and wrote some papers on it. And you know his name. Everybody knows his name. It was Charles Darwin. He did some other things that we might not agree with, but a lot of his work we do agree with. And the pigeon experiments we have no problem believing what he wrote about pigeons. Now, some time went on, and another person did some experiments with inheritance of traits. He was a monk in what's now Czechoslovakia, in a little town called Brno, B-R-N-O. He was a monk that had the responsibility for maintaining the garden. So he maintained a garden and a greenhouse, a Catholic monk. He also was a physicist. He had also been trained as a physicist. And as a physicist, I can tell you, you just have to think of things to do. You're not happy just sitting around. You've got to think of some experiment to do. So while he was gardening, he had to think, well, let's see now. I've got to be interested in something. I've got peas. I've got peas with round seeds. I've got peas with crinkled seeds. I've got peas that have short stalks, peas that have long stalks. I've got peas with white flowers. I've got peas with purple flowers. If I breed these, if I mix them, make a hybrid, what will I get? That's a natural question for him to ask. He had to ask something. What else do you do when you're a garden raising things? He didn't have a laboratory, or maybe his little garden was a laboratory. So he, and of course his name was Gregor Mendel. And you know his name, you know Mendelian genetics. And he started it all by looking at peas. So he said, well, okay, suppose, and you breed peas, of course, by taking a little brush and you get the pollen on one pea and you put it on the flower of the other, and that fertilizes this, so then the progeny will come out. So you'll have peas which you plant and you see what results. So he took, for example, he took pea vines where the peas were round. And then he took pea vines where the peas were crinkled. And he crossed those to get children. And what do you think the peas should be like? If you were to do the experiment, and you had like a mother that was round and a father that was crinkled, what would you expect children to be like?
Round,
crinkled.
Yeah, they could be round, they could be crinkled, they could be sort of half crinkled. They turned out to be round. They were all round. That's a little surprising. I mean, if I were to guess without doing any experiments, I'd say, well, they were sort of half crinkled. Then he did experiments. He did a lot of experiments. I'm only going to talk about a couple. He did experiments with short peas and long peas, short vines and long vines. And he basically bred those. And what did he get? He got all long stalk peas. All around, no short ones. And then he took these long stalk peas that he got, and he bred those, basically. And what did he get? He got peas that were 3/4 long and 1/4 short. Very strange results at that time. They're strange even to us. You read these papers of his, and it hurts the mind to read all this. It's very strange things happen. So he formulated a theory, or a hypothesis probably. A hypothesis is what you start, that's a guess of what happens. In the science terms, a theory is very well supported by a lot of experiments. It's really very close to the truth, and then a law is so well established that it's almost undeniable. Doesn't necessarily mean it's absolutely true, but it means it's within the conditions in which it applies, it's pretty close to the truth. So he postulated that, well, inheritance, there's something in each of these peas that that is involved in inheritance. And when he mixes two, when he takes, in this case, like a mother and a father, and he mixes them, the children, the resulting children, have properties of each of them. But it doesn't always come out. And of course, we see that in humans. We have a mother and a father, and one has blue eyes, and one has brown eyes, and the children usually have brown eyes. And we kind of understand that now, because blue is a recessive color. Well, the idea of recessive and dominant in inheritance came from Mendel. He did figure that out. But he didn't know the concept of the gene. He didn't know that came later. All he knew was that there was something in these pea plants that were responsible for transferring traits to their children, if you will. So that was, he published a paper in 1866. On his results. And it was forgotten. Nobody read it. Who cares about peas in 1866? They were doing other things. In this country, we were worrying about Civil War and reparation and reconstruction and things. Nobody cared about peas. But in 1900, when things had sort of settled down in the world, I guess, somebody read his paper that was interested in inheritance. And then that started other people to do research along the same lines. And one of them was a man by the name of Thomas Hunt Morgan, T.H. Morgan. And he was interested in inheritance. Now, if you're going to study inheritance, who do you want to study it? Well, people are not very good, because the time between when we're born and when we're ready to have children is very long, 15, 20, 25 years. So you can, in a lifetime, you can only study a few generations. And we also have ethical questions about using humans. So humans were not good. Pigeons are a little better, because pigeons breed faster. Peas are okay, but they're not great, because in most climates, you can only grow one crop of peas a year. So it takes a long time. You have to be something like a monk to have the time to do this. So peas weren't good. Well, what would be good? What would be good to study genetics? Well, what we call genetics, they didn't know that then. What would be good to study the inheritance of traits?
Lies.
Well, you'd like something that nobody likes. Last week at Holden Village, you would have picked the black fly. They were awful. The mosquito you could pick too, but it's kind of small. The black fly is bigger. So you'd like something that nobody likes, that replicates very fast. The generation time is very short. And so the fruit fly was picked. And they got their fruit flies by hanging a bunch of bananas out in the stick in their lab, and the bananas sort of kind of rotted, and that attracted the fruit flies. They captured them in bottles, and those were the fruit flies they used. And Morgan did experiments with fruit flies. He could breed two fruit flies together and see what happens, and see what the children of these fruit flies look like, and then he could breed the children. And, well, it turns out that when a fruit fly is born, within a week, you can start breeding them again. So you have a very short generation time. Now, one of the things that happens in inheritance is that there are mutations that occur. Some mutations are good, some mutations are bad. Fruit flies, there are mutations, and he would get mutated fruit flies. He had one that had white eyes. And they consider that very valid, because now they can breed the white eye fruit fly with the red eye fruit. Most fruit flies have red eyes. So he'd meet white eyes with red eyes and see what he got. It's like breeding a Burmese cat, which has yellow eyes, with some other cat which has green eyes, but nobody would do that. Burmese cat breeders won't do that. They'd get thrown out of the society if they did something like that. It's a very, the breeding is very controlled, unless you're a rebel or something. So he studied fruit flies, and there were mutations that occurred, and he could try to breed flies with certain mutations with other ones to see what he got. And he was able to study the inheritance of traits, and he could do a lot of experiments in a fairly short time. And he spent a lifetime doing it. He was still doing experiments at like 70 years old. He had started out, I think, at Columbia University, and then he moved to Caltech. Now, California Institute of Technology is a hotbed of physics and chemistry. I mean, it's the mecca of physics and chemistry on the West Coast. It's like MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, is on the East Coast. So when T.H. Hunt went there, all of a sudden he was in contact with a lot of physicists. Now, physicists have a strange view of the world. It's different from biologists and zoologists and people, and particularly from Morgan, because he was trained as a sort of a natural histologist. He was trained to go around and, I guess, classify plants and things, but he all of a sudden he had interaction with physicists, and there's often a lot of ideas that come in one field that move into another. There's things in science that have moved into religion. And maybe if someone wants, I'll talk about that next year, but I don't want to talk about it now. But in this case, when Morgan went there and interacted with physicists, one of the things that had happened in physics about this time, this was the early 1900s, Niels Bohr had postulated a model of the atom. And it's one that we still use today. We know it's not quite true, but it's a good model to think about. Things had been quantized, essentially. The quantum theory of physics was being developed. And this was a theory that said that, well, energy is in little quanta. It's in little packets. It's not in waves. The new things are in waves. Waves have great power. Like the tsunami had enormous power, wiped out a whole village, killed a lot of people. Waves carry energy. The quantum theory said, well, but that's true, waves carry energy, but a lot of times when you measure things, what it appears to be is in particles, in packets, in quanta, in little groups. Well, Morgan had interaction with the people who believed that. And we do believe that now, and that's turned out to be a valuable theory in physics. So, possibly as a result of that interaction with physicists, he came to the concept of the gene. The gene was some kind of a unit of trait. It would be maybe a unit of yellow eyes in Burmese cats. They had yellow eyes because they had a gene for yellow eyes. And that was one of Morgan's contributions, this idea of genes. Now, at that time, people had good microscopes, pretty good microscopes then. And they could look at cells. They could even look at taking an egg from a female animal, taking a sperm from a male animal, putting them together, and they could watch the sperm inject something into the egg, and they could see what happens. And what they saw was that inside these eggs there were these little thread-like things. Like if you do it in a fruit fly is easier than a human, because a fruit fly has only four pair of these thread-like things that you see. And they didn't know what these thread-like things were. They called them chromosomes, but they knew very little about them. They soon figured out, well, they had something to do with the inheritance of traits. And when they watched these little thread-like things happen, when the male sperm came into the egg, it brought with it its own little thread, and it brought the female thread, and they twined around one another. You could watch it in a microscope. You could see them twining around and then breaking apart, like doing a dance. They were doing some kind of a dance. Nobody knew why this happened, but it's miraculous to watch. I've seen such things in my laboratory, not with this, but with cells doing things, looking at cells and seeing cells doing something that you didn't expect them to do. So this must have been really something miraculous for Morgan. So Morgan said that on these chromosomes contain genes, and there are genes for eye color, for skin color, for height, for many, many things. All the things we attribute to people, or animals, are coded in these genes. And he could do studies like, well, if they do something, one thing that Morgan also found was that you could have, I think this was 1911, you could have crossing over of genes. You could have two of these chromosomes, and part of one chromosome would sort of go over to the other. It would exchange parts of themselves. Didn't know why. That's called crossing over. So you could somehow take part of the chromosome, which might have been a gene. They didn't know that. Maybe this is a gene. Gene transfer from one chromosome to the other. That'll be important later. And he found that. And he published it in 1911. So after Morgan, there came a paper, a little book, by Erwin Schrödinger called What is Life? Now, Erwin Schrödinger he's no longer alive, a very famous German physicist, very well established, very important in the quantum theory that physics were developed in the mid-30s and so on. And he wrote this little book called What is Life? And what that book did, he didn't know what life was. He was sort of, what is life? Question mark. And he was raising this idea, well, maybe there were things that were transmitted in life from the parents to the children, and you know, how do you define life? We still kind of have that problem. How do we define life? So because of this book, other physicists read the book and got really interested in biology. Now, when I took biology, I avoided anything. And when I took physics, I avoided biology like the plague. I didn't take any courses. I didn't want to know anything about biology. Even after I got my doctorate and was doing research, there was no way I wanted to know anything about biology. That obviously changed, but that, you know, I don't want to, you know, they do awful things. Anyway, Schrödinger wrote this book that was read by mainly physicists and chemists and people. They said, man, this is an interesting field. There's a lot to learn here. So a lot of physicists came over. And I think that's one of the reasons that biology has moved so fast. It's a very rapidly moving thing. Because one of the things the physicists did, they brought new blood into the field. They brought new ideas, new ways of doing things. And the field was ripe for that. So, in 1953, another Seymour Benzer got involved in fruit fly research. Now, he was a physicist that had worked on the development of the transistor. So he had a lab on the East Coast, and he got interested in genetics, and he moved his lab to Caltech again, where Morgan was, and Richard Feynman, a very famous physicist who would have been very happy up here, because Feynman was very famous for playing the bongo drums. He played bongo drums really well, carried them everywhere he went. He was quite a character. So, Seymour Benzer read the book, Schrödinger's book, learned something, and says, "Boy, I got to do this." So he did a lot more experiments in fruit flies. He was the fly guy. He was very famous. He spent years and years doing fruit fly experiments. He was kind of a character. He would come into his lab, very late in the day, and he'd work all night. And he'd leave when other people were coming. He ate strange foods. He would eat almost any part of any animal. But he was very, very creative. And he did a lot of experiments which helped us to understand the transmission of traits. He basically helped us to understand the science of genetics. And one of the things he did was to break the gene into parts. So he's responsible for the splitting of genes. So while Morgan had shown that genes could be transferred from one chromosome to the other, Benzer showed that they could be split and divided. That's also going to be important to us later. I might read to you something about that. Or maybe I It says here, the splitting of atoms by Rutherford had led to the atomic bomb, and the splitting of genes by Benzer would lead to an explosion of genetic mapping and genetic engineering that now dominates biology. So Benzer was a pretty influential person. Few people have known his name, even today. Okay. Then also in about, say, year 1953, there were some experiments done in England. People didn't know. They had the idea of genes, and they knew chromosomes, and they knew the genes were somehow on the chromosomes, and they were probably discrete, just like in quantum physics, they're probably discrete. But they didn't know the structure of the chromosome. They didn't know the molecular structure. It was just some strange molecular substance. Well, in England, they did some X-ray experiments. Rosalind Franklin and somebody else did X-rays. Now, we all know what X-rays are. We have X-rays or breast cancer. You think they've broken your bone, they X-ray your arm. We're used to looking at the bones and stuff on an X-ray machine, on an X-ray slide. Well, they did something else called X-ray diffraction. It's the same kind of X-ray, but they do something to it. So instead of getting a picture, they get a bunch of spots on a film. And you do X-ray, you get, you know, a ring of spots here, and above that you get another ring of spots. And by looking at the spacing of the ring of spots and the spacing here, you can tell something about the structure of what you're looking at. This was something that came out of physics a long time ago. It had been used in metallurgy. It's used in crystallography. It tells us what the structure of diamond is and the structure of various other gemstones and things. But when they looked at chromosomes, they found these spots. Now, I've looked at X-ray diffraction patterns, and man, it's all Greek to me. That is not my expertise. I've taken class, I've been taught, so I can find certain things, but they're just, you know, people look and they say, I don't know what that is. Well, it turned out that this group in England looked and they had a eureka moment, and they said, oh, I know, I can explain this. Now, they don't know why the spots are there, because again, that's a religious question. The problem is, how do you explain these spots? So they had an idea as to what the structure was, and of course, then very soon afterwards, Watson and Crick came up with a model of the chromosome, with DNA, the double helical molecule that is the atomic model of the chromosome. And there are four units, A, T, G, C, adenosine, cytosine, whatever, A, T, G, C. And they are repeated on the chromosome at regular intervals. It's always A, T, G, C, it could be A, G, CET or something, it's a different combination, but they go down this one of the strands of DNA. One strand of DNA you get from your mother. The other strand of DNA you get from your father, and when the cells are fertilized, these two strands come together, and they have the complete genetic makeup of you. All of your genetic makeup is in there. Now, that all of our cells have these two strands, one from the father and one from the mother. And in humans, we have 46 chromosomes, 23 pair. One of the chromosome pairs has what's called an X gene on it. And there's another one that has a Y gene. Females have, in their cell, you take out a cell from your skin or whatever, they have two X genes. Males have an X and a Y. That distinguishes men from women. Women are defined by having two X's. Men are defined by having an X and a Y, and that difference is enough to change our sex from male to female, or to explain our sex. Now, I said that all cells have 46 chromosomes. The exception is the egg, the ovum in the woman, and the sperm in the man. They only have half that many. They have 23. There's a process in the body called meiosis, M-E-I-O-S-I-S. That's a process where a cell that has normally that has 46 chromosomes divides into two cells, each with 23. And that's how you form the egg and the sperm in humans. So that's a cell, that's the way you make ovum and sperms. You also have a process in physiology or whatever, cell reproduction of mitosis, where one cell multiplies into another just like itself. That's mitosis, an important phenomena. So we have we had when Watson and Crick came, we had this, all of a sudden, we had a model, a sort of a physical model. We could understand what the chromosome was. We could understand where the information was that comes from the transmission of traits from one person to another. We had techniques for doing gene transfer at around that time. We could take a gene from one chromosome and put it in. That's, of course, what Morgan observed. And people developed ways of doing that in real life. We had ways of making animals that are called transgenic animals. There's a lot of transgenic mice around. I had the opportunity to work on one, and I sort of didn't want to, so I never did. But they take a mouse and they take out one gene and they put in a different gene from a different animal. So you've got an animal that has genes from two different animals, and it grows and it has certain properties that you want to study. It was called transgenic animals, and people can do that. Whether or not they should do it is what we'll talk about Thursday. We're just talking about now what they can do. They can do that. They can do genetic engineering. Whether you should or not, that's Thursday's up. Now I'd like to talk, now that's the end of one thread of my discussion. We kind of now have gotten to the part where we know where the genetic information is. We know that people know its molecular structure. So now chemists can work on it. As soon as you know the molecular structure, then chemists can work. They work with molecules and atoms, and they can do studies of changing things around. So we knew a lot in 53, and we've progressed a long way from that. Let me go back now and do another thread, which I'll bring together at the end. And that's this area of reproduction. Now, I've talked about eggs and sperm getting together. Now, I have to tell you a little story. After I got my doctorate, I went to Tulane University, and I was doing physics. And the biologist would come in, and I was doing nuclear magnetic resonance, a great giant magnet. They would come in and say, can I put my frog in your magnet? I think, go, you're no way you're going to put your frog in my magnet, you know, contaminate. I'm pure, I don't want this impure frog in my magnet. So I, you know, no way, but I talked to them. And then one night, when I was working in the laboratory, one of them came up to me, knocked on the door, and said, hey, Ron, you want to go catch frogs? And I said, what? He said, you want to go catch frogs? And I said, why do you want to? Well, because we're doing research on frogs. I said, well, yeah, sure, that sounds like fun. So we got in a truck, we drove around, and this time we drove over to Audubon Park, which is in New Orleans. And we looked around in the bushes, and I happened to find this great big bullfrog. They didn't find anything. So we brought the bullfrog back, and from then on, they thought I was wonderful. I brought them great luck, and I found this big frog. And so finally I asked them, I said, what do you want these frogs for? What do you do frogs? So they took me and they showed me frogs. They had them in a big cold room where they had all these little boxes, sort of like shoe boxes, plastic shoe boxes, and they all had frogs in them. And they showed me this frog. And this frog was a big adult frog. It was, you know, it was living fine. But on the left side of the frog, it was spotted. And on the right side of the frog was striped. And I looked at that frog and I thought, man, I mean, this is a miracle. How can you bring that about? Now, if I say, why is a frog like that? You say, well, God wanted it that way. If you say, well, how does that come about? How do you explain that? How do you get such a frog? And that's weird. That's really weird. And they said, well, the way we do that is we take a spotted frog and we take a fertilized egg from a spotted frog. And we also take a striped frog, we take a fertilized egg from that. And after about 3 or 4 days, what we do is we cut the egg in half from the spotted frog, and we cut the egg in half from the striped frog, and we take half of this and half of this, we put them together, and they stick. And they grow into this frog, with spotted on one side and striped on the other. I know, the world is orderly to me. This was weird. So I asked them, I said, well, you know, I don't think they used the word stem cell then. That hadn't cropped into our vocabulary yet, but they had this phenomenon. So I asked them, I said, what are the interesting problems in biology? And he told me that one of the problems that's been around for a long time, and it's never been solved, is the problem of cellular differentiation. Now, this was back a long time ago. I mean, I'm only 39 now, but this was back like 35 years or so. So this problem of cellular differentiation, that these early cells that come from the fertilization of an egg and sperm, which we now call stem cells, they're embryonic stem cells, they multiply. They can get up to, one cell becomes 2, 2, 4, 4, 8, so on, 16, they get up to 32 or so cells. And they're all the same, they're all stem cells. They don't have any particular characteristics. But then at the time of cellular differentiation, which is still a mystery, nobody has solved that problem. A lot of people are working on it because there's good economic reasons to work on it. But I don't think it's solved yet. Certainly wasn't solved then. This process of cellular differentiation, which to me was magical. It's the miracle of birth to me. That at some point, when you have enough of these stem cells, these cells start to differentiate, which means they turn into other cells of the body. Some of them turn into skin cells, some of them into heart cells, some of them into lung cells, eye cells. They turn into cells of the various tissues of our body. And you say, why does that happen? It happens because God wants it to happen. How does it happen? That's what the scientist has to try to figure out. How can we explain this phenomenon? That particular phenomenon, I think people still don't understand. However, if the stem cells have this kind of power, you can do various things with them. For example, you can do cloning. You can take these stem cells, divide them into two, and maybe put one of the eggs into another woman, and she develops something just like the first one, cloning of a human being. You could, of course, clone plants too. You don't have to just do with people. You can clone animals, plants. There's other ways of doing cloning, but that's one way. A clone is an animal or a plant or something that has exactly the same genetic makeup as the first one. And we can do that artificially. Now, nature does it too. Sometimes, for reasons that aren't understood, this embryo will divide into two embryos. And then you get identical twins, or divides into three, you get triplets, identical triplets or something. Now, that's a natural process, unless you somehow induce it by something. And I think it was reported some years ago that women who were on birth control pills for a while and then stopped taking them, they had a higher incidence of pregnancy, and I think they had a higher incidence of identical twins and triplets and things. So maybe the taking of the birth controls is a drug method for producing something which is not normally occurring. We have to decide, is that good or bad? Don't know, that's an ethical question. So, we, in the case of, actually I've been doing cloning for years. I'm a cloner by nature. I've cloned for probably 30, 40, 50 years I've been doing cloning. So a lot of other people. I do it in my garden. One of the things I like to grow are tomatoes. Sometimes a tomato plant grows and I've got an extra space over here that something else has died or I have space. I can clone a tomato plant just by cutting off a limb and putting it in the ground. And tomatoes root very easily and it'll grow into an identical plant. Those two plants have exactly the same genetic makeup. They have the same set of genes. So they are clones of one another. We have no ethical problems with that kind of cloning, but it's been going on for years. There are a lot of plants that are now cloned. The cloning of people is disapproved by, I think, every government in the world. It's whether some rogue group will do it or not, we don't know. The answer is, well, probably they will. We can't control everybody. But it's an ethical question. Now, one of the things, now you can do it in other ways. The idea of cloning and genetic manipulation is to create an egg that will grow that has a certain genetic makeup, controlled genetic makeup. One of the things that we heard about just this last spring is the group in Korea at Seoul National University. And they've been doing these studies for several years now, but they finally perfected it to the point where it's really a remarkable study. And they take and do, they don't call it cloning. They don't like the word cloning. They call it nuclear transfer. So they'll take an egg or a woman, And they say they somehow squeeze it with chopsticks. And they claim the reason they're so successful is they use Korean chopsticks. And I believe that. Chinese chopsticks are big, and you know, big ends and round and square ends, and they're, you know, I learned to use those as a kid in like Chinese restaurants. When I lived in Japan, I learned to use Japanese chopsticks, which are much smaller and have a pointy end, and I kind of got to where I could use those, and I like those a lot now. When I went to Korea, I saw Korean chopsticks, and they're very tiny, and they're made out of metal, and they have square ends, and for the life of me, I cannot pick up anything with them. It's just too hard. I suppose with practice I could, but no, I could not. So the Koreans are used to these slippery things for them to pick up an egg and not have it fall out, and they squeeze it. And the nucleus comes out, and then they insert a new nucleus into it. From a new genetic, they insert new DNA. They get off the DNA, which is in the nucleus, and they insert new DNA in. And that's a much more successful way than the Americans and others were doing, because they were taking the egg, and they were taking a glass, a hollow glass tube. They were pulling it out into a fine, very fine point, and then with means of a little micro manipulator, and by looking into the microscope, you can take this fine pointy thing, poke it into the female egg, and suck out the nucleus, and then put a new one in. And we've done, not those kind of experiments, we've done things with micropipettes, and it's doable with cells. You have to have good hands and to do it, because it's a very, but you know, you can train people to do it, and they do it. Well, the success rate of puncturing and sucking is much smaller than what the Koreans have done. They have a much higher success rate. Now, but they're not interested in cloning. The Korean government prevents them from doing human cloning experiments. So what do you want these stem cells for? I mean, who cares whether you have them? Why do you want to grow them? And why do you want to grow these embryonic stem cells rather than something else? You say, well, you know, aren't there adult stem cells? Well, the answer is yes, there are. And I'm not positive, and since I don't have access to the internet, I can't check. But I think the first adult stem cells were found by a colleague of mine, and they were in the periphery of the cornea of the eye, the front layer of cells of the cornea of the eye. And that was, I don't know, I forget how long ago. It must have been, well, it's probably been 12, 13 years ago now. And he discovered stem cells here. And at the time when I heard about it, I asked him to speak at a meeting I was organizing in Sarasota. He spoke, and I heard him talk about this later thing he found. And so I said, well, ho-hum, I mean, you know, that's interesting, but why do I care about that? Nobody thought much about stem cells, and except a few people who were doing work. And now we know that actually stem cells are very nice, because if you can get a stem cell to differentiate into something else, if you can get a stem cell to differentiate in a heart cell and get that cell in the heart, it might cure heart disease. If you can get a stem cell to differentiate into a pancreatic islet cell, and you get it into the pancreas of somebody with diabetes, that cell will start making insulin, which is not made by his cells. The diabetic has there is some gene that he is missing, or maybe he has two that he shouldn't have. There's something in his DNA. There's something in his genes that prevent him from making enough insulin to live. So because of the lack of insulin, he doesn't get sugar to be transported through from the bloodstream into the tissues. And tissues need that. They need the sugar. It's glucose. It's a very simple sugar. What's in corn syrup, basically. So if you can take these stem cells and get them to differentiate into a pancreatic islet cell that makes insulin, and you get it in there, you've cured his diabetes. You've saved him from really a lifetime of a lot of problems. At best, he has to take injections periodically. He's got type 1 diabetes. He's got to take an injection periodically. At worst, he goes blind. He has to get his leg or arm or something cut off because he has poor circulation. So the question is, should you use stem cells for that purpose? That's Thursday's talk, or discussion. It's going to be more of a discussion than a talk. One of the papers I heard just last May, early May of this year, I was off to a meeting in Fort Lauderdale. We have a big international eye research meeting. And most of my work has been done in eye research, in cells of the cornea, actually. And they had two sessions devoted to stem cells. First time they've ever had that. And I went to them, and I heard what people had to say. in the eye, there are a couple of really, really bad diseases that none of us want to get. And the fear of going blind is one of the great fears of us. Nobody likes the thought of going blind. One of the things that causes blindness is macular degeneration. That's a disease of the part of the retina that we use to see the finest in. When we look at something and we read something, the letters or whatever we're looking at fall on the macula of our retina. The retina is a big, it's not this big, it's probably about that big. But let me make it, it's this big. And so the retina is very big. It's got a place where all the nerves go into the brain and take the information from the photoreceptors. And that's got all these photoreceptors. Photoreceptors take the light that fall on them and convert it into an electrical signal which goes to the nerves, which goes to the brains, which the brain interprets as images, so we can read. How well we can read depends on how close together the photoreceptors are. It also depends on what kind. There's two kinds, rods and cones. And the rods, which are out of the periphery of the retina, those only see black and white. But they're very, very sensitive. They're very sensitive. That's why we can see at night in very dim light. We can walk out in the moonlight. We don't fall over things because we can see. But if you've ever noticed, all you see is black and white. The rods do not see color. The cones, on the other hand, which are more in this central region where you're looking, they do see color. But because they see color, they're not as sensitive to light. It's like video cameras, if you will. A black and white video camera is much more sensitive than a color video camera. So we're used to this concept of, if you want color, it's not as bright, it costs you more, it's you know, whatever. Well, the eye is made like that. So in the middle, where these photoreceptors are, they're primarily cones. What happens is that in many people, as we age, these photoreceptors die. They die. And we also get other things. We get exudates. We get little pockets of fluid and something in this thing which inhibit our vision. So we don't like that. My father had macular degeneration when he got old. It was a major problem for him because he was a lifelong reader all of his life. All of a sudden he couldn't read. He couldn't read. He couldn't play golf. And I think he died. He basically, he was like in his late 80s. I think he just gave up. Life wasn't fun to him. So he stopped fighting for life. And he died. He didn't die of a heart attack. He just sort of gave up, I guess. None of us like to go blind. What they have found is if they take stem cells and they insert them into the retina, they have to do surgery from the back of the eye, and it's very experimental. If they insert them into the retina, what do you think happens with those stem cells?
Turn into rod cells.
They convert to the shape of rods. They begin to look like rods. Or excuse me, look like cones. Begin to look like cones. You couldn't, by looking at them with an electron microscope, you couldn't tell them between a normal cone. So they look like cones. They haven't shown that they develop the neural connections so that they improve your vision. That's the next step. In science, you can't always do everything in one blow. It takes time to do things. The fact that they could get them to differentiate into what appears to be a cone cell is just miraculous. Why does it do that? Because God wants it to do that. How does it do it? That's what we have to find out. That's what the science finds out. There are also diseases like of the cornea of the eye. If you get an alkali burn, I mean, there were cases years ago of some mobster got through lye into somebody's eye, and you get an alkali burn, a chemical burn of the cornea. Well, you can get a transplant, but unfortunately, in alkali burns, transplants very seldom take. They're rejected. So you get a second transplant. The second transplant has a much poorer chance of survival than the first. It's probably not any use to try this. So somebody will go blind from these chemical burns. That's why you want to be very careful with drain cleaners around your house or lye, because you get that in your eye, you don't want to get it in your eye. You want to keep it away from yourself, kids. Better not to have it unless you really know how to be careful with it. So they've taken stem cells, in this case adult stem cells, from the outside of the cornea, or the periphery of the cornea, and they've grown them into membranes that they can put on the cornea, and that seems to make the corneas transparent again. It's a much better technique than to do a corneal transplant, which doesn't work without blood burns. It works for a lot of things, but not blood burns. So these are two examples I remember from, this is of last May. This was only a couple months ago. Now the question is, well, now here are adult, what's the difference between adult stem cells and embryonic stem cells? Well, adult stem cells are not quite as early as embryonic stem cells. They have sort of partially differentiated it. You know, if you take a corneal adult stem cell, it could differentiate into some other parts of the cornea, but it will not go back and differentiate into a heart stem cell. You can get de-differentiation of cells. And we've seen it, we saw it in my lab in certain corneal diseases where the cells apparently revert back to an earlier stage. And then they usually do something you'd like them not to do, like make a bulge or something, but they can de-differentiate. There's not any active work going on in there that I know of now. Most of it is in the differentiation of stem cells. Now, the problem with adult stem cells, there's a couple of them. One is, you are limited into what kind of tissue, what kind of cells you can differentiate into. The other thing is that cells have this property that the older they are, the less able they are to do things. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. We can. Let me sort of finish here. The embryonic stem cells are much younger, and they have more parts. Like people, as we get older, there's less we can do. I can no longer carry an 80-pound pack and walk up to Lyman Lake in a day. I wouldn't even try it. When I was a kid, I could do that fine. My traits are different than they were when I was younger, and that's true of cells too. Embryonic stem cells have power that adults don't, and maybe we can stop here and we'll go on Thursday and carry on here and talk more about what are the ethics of this, and also what are the consequences of whatever decisions we make. We are now forced to make some decisions. We can't not make them, because they'll be made for us. They'll be made for us by another country, by other people. So we have to do something, and it's a problem of science, it's a problem of ethics, it's a problem of religion, and we have to do something. So Thursday we'll talk about that. We'll discuss that.